author of The Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, photojournalist and photographer, Alex Schlacher.
Hi.
Hi. We are looking at your book, The Ark of the Gurkha. But before that, I want to talk about you as a photographer, what led you to photography, and what led you to this story.
I started taking pictures when I was four. Mm-hmm. My grandmother gave me one of her old cameras, and I just started snapping away. And I've taken pictures my whole life, but I never considered making it a profession, because everything that seemed like a sort of a feasible option in the photography sector, I really didn't want to do. I didn't want to do fashion or architecture, or weddings, or you know, any of that. So I figured it'll stay a hobby. And then a few years ago, I embarked on a project on U.S. law enforcement, and I was embedded with American police departments around the South and Midwest. And
how did that happen? Because you're not American.
No, it was, I think it was 2009 when there was a strike in Naples, and it was the garbage men that striked. Garbage personnel, and within a couple of weeks, the city was, you know,
engulfed in garbage.
Yep, yeah. And everyone was yelling cholera, and it was a very big deal. And it occurred to me, you know, the obvious, that a lot of professions that are on the low scale of, you know, salary wise, but also in recognition, are the ones that are the most essential. And if, you know, people like garbage men or cleaning personnel or caretakers or teachers or, you know, first responders, if they stop doing their work, then within just a few days, society would just, you know, descend into chaos. So I thought I want to do a project on these kinds of professions. When I started, and that included police. And when I started researching, I figured it was just too broad a spectrum. I needed to box it in a little. And I focused on police, particularly American police, because the image that we have of American police, reinforced by recent events, obviously, is either really terrible or is what we see in the movies and TV shows, which is also not really what the reality is like. So I wanted to know what it was like for police in America to do their jobs. I did not know a single cop, and I just wrote to my friends in the States saying, does anybody know anyone who knows a police officer? And I mapped out my road trip around the South and Midwest, and I figured if I didn't meet a single police officer, I'll have a nice road trip and a little holiday and take a few pictures. But when I went over there, all the doors opened. Surprisingly, they were very welcoming. Police departments ended up calling me saying, we have a really nice SWAT team. Do you want to come over and take pictures as well? And I was embedded with everybody from normal patrol officers to undercover drugs, homicide, CSI, SWAT, K-9, bomb squad. It was just really interesting, and they all just let me ride with them. And because I said, I have no agenda. I just want to know what it's like for you to do your job. And essentially, it's a human sort of thing. Everybody wants to be seen, and everybody mm-hmm. wants to be understood. And I think if you approach a subject that way, without an agenda, without your own preformed opinion, and just say, I want to know what it's like for you to mm-hmm. do your job, mm-hmm. then people are a lot more open to it. And they trusted me to not publish anything without showing it to them first, because I said, I don't want to, you know, I just really want to know what this is like for you. And not from our perspective, but from yours. So yeah. I just tried to, you know, take myself out of the equation completely and try to be as neutral as possible. And I stayed in contact after I left the States. I stayed in contact with a few of these guys. And one of them was a then deputy chief, now police chief of a police department in Georgia, and who was also a reserve U.S. Marine colonel. And he wrote me an email saying, I'm being deployed to Afghanistan to mentor the Afghan National Police. At which point I thought, oh, that maybe I'll do a global police project and include other countries' police mm-hmm. departments. So I said, I want to come. And he said, well, if you make it down to us, we'll take you. And so I embarked on, you know, the accreditation process with NATO, and for some weird reason got accredited, because Austrian journalists really hadn't been embedded with American forces before, and ended up in Helmand in 2011.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
What does it mean to be embedded?
To be embedded means you basically run with a unit, be it law enforcement or army or navy, marines, whatever, and you basically do what they do. You go on patrol with them, you eat with them, you live where they live. That's being embedded, as opposed to flying in, having doing an interview, taking a few pictures, and flying out. You stay with mm-hmm. them. You basically live with them. It's what journalists and photographers have done for probably centuries. There's always been journalists embedded with army units in mm-hmm. wars.
There always have been, but there's also in these recent wars, it's only been embedded journalists who have been allowed to have stories.
Yes.
So, and what's your feeling on that? Because you said, you know, it's my job to be neutral. But how do you approach, I mean, to me, it seems, you know, a bit like us, because we interview people we're interested in. So we already have a bias towards them,
yeah,
as opposed to a bias against,
right.
You know, which I suppose a more investigative journalists do.
Right.
You know, the perception is, as an embedded journalist, you have a bias towards. Is that your experience? And how did you run into anything that struck you as iffy or uncomfortable, and what did you do with those feelings or pictures?
The difficult thing is, and I'm sure that a lot of people have this experience, that the older you get, the more complicated life becomes mm-hmm. because you see all those gray areas that weren't there before when you were 20 and everything was black and white and you mm-hmm. know what was right and wrong. And then as you get older, you know, and as you delve more into subjects, as you have more, you know, develop more empathy towards your environment, the more complicated things become. And especially when it comes to war, that's exactly what happened to me. I'm a natural, I don't want to say pacifist, because everyone has a different interpretation of what that word means, but obviously nobody wants war, except for possibly the weapons industry. But mm-hmm. So I very much sympathized with the civilians. I had researched the history of Afghanistan before I went down there, and it's horrific. These people have been invaded time and again, over and over and over, for thousands of years now, from Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan, you know, the Soviets, the Americans, the British, everybody razed everything to the ground. So the Afghans have never been allowed to sort of cultivate a culture and an identity, because everything's been destroyed on a regular basis. So I very much sympathized with civilians, and you also understand why these people would then feel antagonistic towards an invading force, no matter why that force is invading. On the other hand, being embedded with soldiers that you strike up friendships with and that you sympathize with, that's the other side. So you understand them as well, and you very much divorce soldiers from people who order wars, from governments. That's mm-hmm. a whole nother story as well. And so there's all these different aspects of it that make life very complicated. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult for me. So I tried to plus when you're in it, when you're right in it, it's very difficult to wrap your head around it anyway, because you have no time. You just work on adrenaline, and you really have no time to think about it. So I just tried to take pictures. I've taken pictures of Taliban members, and I've taken pictures of U.S. Marines and of local Afghan pop. And I've just tried to portray them as people, so they look like normal people, because that's what they are. It's mm-hmm. It's not. It's never easy. Their lives are certainly not easy. And so I tried to take myself out of it again and just take pictures, because everybody who looks at pictures brings their own baggage and their own associations to it anyway. And I don't like it when when I look at a picture and I feel like I'm being manipulated into an opinion. I don't like that, so I try not to do that. Of course, you always have a bias because it's you taking the picture, but I try to be as neutral as possible.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And what were some of the experiences you had?
Oh, God. Some of it was quite difficult. It's the stories that you hear. It's the things that you see. It's the dead bodies that you see. It's when you're constantly surrounded by, it's either gunfire or it's explosions, and it's this carpet of noise in the background. Even when you're at a fairly large camp, that's sort of with you, and you get used to these things frighteningly quickly. Mm-hmm. You just kind of, I don't know, but it's scary how quickly you adjust to something like that. And then, of course, I wasn't always in camp. Occasionally I was on patrol basis where there were no toilets, there were no running water, we were sleeping in clay holes in the wall, basically. But you get used to everything very quickly, especially when you have a job to do, and then it's you don't have time to think anyway, and so you just get through your day. You try to get your material, and you try to survive till the next day, really. Just like the soldiers, just like the civilians, just like everybody else down there. And it's sort of a routine that is on the one hand horrific, but on the other hand very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't have job problems, you don't have relationship problems, you don't have money problems, you don't have to take the trash out. Well, actually, you do have to take the trash out in a camp, but you don't have these normal problems, which is why I understand soldiers who come back from war and say, "I can't deal."
Mm-hmm.
When I came back from Afghanistan, and you sit on public transport and hear people whine about the weather, and it makes it difficult because you feel like you don't belong there. It's very odd readjusting.
Mm. So in a sense, it sounds like you had a level of post-traumatic stress disorder in your own reentry.
I would say bizarrely less so from Afghanistan than I had from being embedded with American police departments.
Why?
Because by the time I got to Afghanistan, I knew how to turn away from it, and I knew how to protect myself from it and not empathize and, well, not empathize too much, just kind of protect myself from it. When I was with police departments in America, I had everything was open. I was trying to empathize. I was trying to understand, and I had never seen a dead body until I got to the States and rode around with police. And then, of course, you see a lot of them, and very tragic stories and homicides and suicides, and it was a lot, mm-hmm. all at the same time. And mm-hmm. they call it rookie syndrome over there, mm-hmm. because it's, you kind of get plunged into it and you
easily overwhelmed. Yeah.
So it was worse there. By the time I got to Afghanistan, I knew how to keep an internal distance. It's always horrific. The things you see are always horrific. And usually it comes afterwards when you have time mm-hmm. to think about it. And you get home and you think about what happened to you and what, you know, if you had been...
What could have happened.
Yeah, but it was okay, actually. It is what it is. And I'm not even a combat photographer. I'm not a frontline photographer.
Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous.
So while I was in Helmand, I ran into the Gurkhas.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew who they were, but I'd never met one. And
well, here we know them because Joanna Lumley tells us who they are tirelessly. But she has really championed the cause of Gurkhas. Because I don't think without that championship, me as an American certainly wouldn't have been aware.
Right.
But I don't think as many people would be aware without that.
Right.
Real championship, and it's a long-standing tradition. If you would introduce us to that a little bit.
Yep. The British, the East India Company, they were sort of pushing north towards Nepal in the early 19th century. And they met with fierce resistance in Nepal. And there were quite a few battles against the Nepali forces. And the British were very impressed by their adversaries. They were incredibly tough warriors, but at the same time, one of them, an officer, was taken prisoner. They were incredibly generous and very polite and treated him with a lot of respect. And he was just very impressed and came away from that experience saying, oh, we need those guys mm-hmm. to fight for us.
They're better with us than against us.
Exactly. So when after the peace treaty with Nepal, granted Britain basically to come to Nepal once a year and recruit warriors. And that's something that has happened every year since until mm-hmm. today. The Gurkhas have been in every major conflict that Britain has fought, usually on the front line. Iraq, Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, Bosnia, Kosovo, Falklands, Second World War, First World War, everywhere. And the reason why they are not as internationally well known as they should be is that they don't like to toot their own horn. They're very modest. They're very quiet. They don't, you know, stand up and say, that was us. It's makes them nice people, but it's a shame because people don't really know who they are. I mean, here in Britain, the Gurkhas are legendary, but that's what they are, the Gurkhas. They are not, people don't know.
They're not individuals.
Exactly. And people don't know their stories. Mm-mm. People, it's, you know, they're like one mass of people. And when I was in Afghanistan, I met them. They kind of took me in like the lost child. They were incredibly nice to me and generous. And
why did they take you in? Is it because you were a woman alone, or
no? Well, I was with the U.S. Marines, and that was mm-hmm. that was basically my purpose down there. My U.S. Marine colonel was really good friends with the lieutenant colonel from 2RGR, the Royal Gurkha Rifles, that were stationed okay. in the same camp. And we all had dinner one night in a tent. Lieutenant Colonel Fraser Ray, then Lieutenant Colonel, now Colonel Fraser Ray, asked me about my project, and then said, well, if you're bored with the Americans, if you want to run with the Gurkhas a little bit. And I said, of course I want to run with the Gurkhas. I mean, that's an invitation that you don't say no to. And then I spent the rest of my time with the Gurkhas in Helmand, mm-hmm. going on patrols with them and running with their police mentors. And they were lovely. They were just very open and very welcoming. And I was insanely curious, and they told me about Nepal and about the recruitment in Nepal every year and about their families, about what it was like to fight for another country. And they were lovely. They were really nice and extremely protective of me, and I felt very safe, and I felt very welcomed and very respected. And that's when this idea started to marinate in my head that I wanted to do a project on them.
And what were the differences? Because I can imagine, I mean, you know, if here's this nice girl from Austria who wants to take some pictures, and, you know, the Marines are like, you know, well, your presence in some way puts them in danger. Was there sometimes that feeling, and was there...
Well, every army unit is used to mm-hmm. having embedded journalists, because that's what happens in every war.
Right.
So if they're all used to it. They all get schooled on it, basically. You always have one person dedicated to your safety, really. But there's also a shit list, really, because there are journalists who endanger their units by just mm-hmm. wandering off. And they usually do not get accredited, or that they don't get invited back, or only very reluctantly. Mm-hmm. If you're always met with certain reservations, and with which is normal, which is completely normal, because this is a person who is a potential liability.
Yeah.
So I completely
yes.
get it.
Yeah.
Especially when it's a woman, I completely get that too, because this is a predominantly male environment still. So I understood, you know, people going, oh, okay, well,
the eye
that
roll.
Be like, yeah. But once they see that you carry your own stuff, you don't whine, you stay in place, you can follow orders, you know, you don't stay lag behind, they don't have to go look for you, then they accept you quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And you get, you're part of the unit, and you kind of you're submerged in the unit, and you become invisible, as in they don't have to, you know, make special arrangements for you. And they, you know, once they know that you're like that and you're fine, then they're fine as well.
Mm-hmm. Does gender sort of disappear in that environment as well?
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. It has to, mm-hmm. because there's no personal space, and mm-hmm. There are no, you know, there are no female toilets, and there's no, you just...
There's no toilets.
But then again, nobody cares. And that's one of the refreshing things as well. Nobody cares what you look like. Nobody cares what you, you know, nothing. You, the only thing people care about is your character and your personalities. Is do you pitch in? What's your attitude? And are you gonna encroach on the safety of the unit? Are you gonna, you know, mm-hmm. are you a liability or are you not a liability? And that's a very refreshing thing, because you can completely focus on what you're doing, because nobody cares about anything else. And that's kind of nice, actually. But mm-hmm. the Gurkhas are, by nature, through their mentality, a very hospitable sort of tribe. The Nepali mentality is very welcoming, very generous, particularly towards guests. And I was considered a guest. And they are... and you can. It was really interesting to see with the police mentors. They're very well respected with the Afghan civilian population, because they're incredibly respectful of their religion and their lifestyle and their attitudes and their just everything about their culture, even though it doesn't correspond with theirs. And that's something that you immediately see when you have a Gurkha police mentor meeting one of their Afghan charges. There's a lot of smiling. There's a lot of. They also share a common language. Most Gurkhas speak Urdu, and most Afghans do as well. So that makes a lot. That makes it a lot easier. but it's mostly the respect that the Gurkhas sort of display towards the civilian population that immediately endeared them to them. So they were very popular mentors.
And what does that respect look like?
Sometimes it's something that you can't even put your finger on, but when you meet somebody and they meet you at your level, and they respect you off the bat, you know. And when somebody condescends to you, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just the way they talk to them, it's the way they sit with them. It's everything from posture to tone of voice to what they say. To the way they listen, a lot of people just tell, and they listen. What do you need? What, you know? They gave them space to for their religion and their culture. They were very respectful of it. So, and of course, the you know, the Afghans noticed, and I noticed as well. I was really impressed, and I was just impressed with their general attitude and their personalities and. The way they handle their jobs with, you know, completely stoic. There's nobody yelling, no one getting upset about. They're just very balanced and very good-natured people.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
And what is the position of Gurkhas in Nepali society?
They're revered. They're quite admired. Mm. And it's every boy in, well, not every boy, but 95% of boys probably in Nepal want to be Gurkhas for several reasons. One smaller reason is the money, because being a part of the British Army is, of course, a huge salary hike for them, and they can take care of their families. And their future is pretty much safeguarded. However, it is also a huge honor. It is a huge honor, and they take this very, very seriously. A lot of Nepali families have Gurkhas in their ancestry, a lot of them. And for a boy to be admitted into the British, particularly the British Army, there are Gurkhas in the Indian Army and the Singapore Police and the Gurkha Reserve Unit in Brunei as well, but particularly the British Army has a certain prestige. And they're legends. The Gurkhas are legends also to the Nepali. They're immensely proud of them, and so they should be. So still, every year, there are between 10 and 20,000 boys applying for between 120 and what this year was 250 places in wow. the British Army. So, and everyone gets a maximum, I think, of 4 tries because you have to be between 17 and a half and 21. So if you start when you're 17 and a half and you fail several times, you know, by the time you're 22, you have to stop. So 21's the last time, it's a cutoff. But they really, they train all year. And then, you know, if they fail, they train again. And it's usually sometimes their families have to take out a loan to train them. And to, you know, it's a big, big deal over there.
And did you say you traveled with them to Brunei to see what the Gurkhas there are doing?
Yeah. Well, there's a one infantry regiment split into two battalions. That's one Royal Gurkha Rifles and two Royal Gurkha Rifles. And one of them is in Brunei and one of them is in the UK. And they mm-hmm. rotate every sort of 3 to 4 years. So there's always a battalion of Gurkhas in Brunei, as well as the Gurkha Reserve Unit, which is usually made up of Gurkha veterans who are a special unit assigned to the Sultan of Brunei. But the Royal Gurkha Rifles that are stationed in Brunei, they spend a lot of their time doing jungle training, which is their natural terrain, really. And I was in Brunei twice. The first time was a tactical exercise in the jungle, and the second time was the junior leadership cadre, which is the first big strategic and tactical exam mm-hmm. in a young Gurkha's life.
Mm-hmm. And what is it like for them to, I mean, what is the stance? I mean, those are two very different details, and they're essentially, I guess, at that point, mercenaries.
No, it's a slightly different thing
because mercenaries
mercenaries are basically
soldiers
outsourced. Yeah, exactly. And the Gurkhas are not, because the Gurkhas are a part of the British Army. So they are British soldiers, even though they are from somewhere else. Mercenaries are never a part of the actual army. They're contractors, but the Gurkhas aren't contractors. They are a part of the British Army. So they are, the officers' ranks are made up of Gurkha officers and British officers. Mm-hmm. Used to be just British officers, but at this point now there are also Gurkha officers. So there's a good, healthy mix.
How does that work when it switches over to the Brunei detail?
They just move, basically. They move house.
But then they're no longer part of the British Army.
Yeah, they are.
Oh, is that still part of?
Well, the GRU isn't, the Gurkha Reserve Unit, but those are veterans. They're finished with the army. Okay. But the British, the Brigade of Gurkhas is a part of the British Army. And the Brigade of Gurkhas has one infantry regiment split into the two battalions, one in Brunei and one in the UK. Mm-hmm. And then they have the engineers, the signalers, the loggies, and the clerks, basically, and the band. Sorry, forgot the band. those are the regiments.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
You know, I mean, a lot of what you saw while you were embedded was very hard, but I'm sure there were a lot of, you know, there's always moments of beauty in situations like that. So were there moments of beauty for you?
Yes. One of them was my favorite exercise, really, was the one in the jungle, the first tactical exercise I was ever on, which was the hardest physically and mentally. But it was just, the Gurkhas made me feel like I was part of the family. And operating in that kind of environment where you feel completely protected and accepted and respected, and there was a lot of warmth towards me and my project, because I told them that I just wanted to know their lives and I wanted to introduce them to a British audience. So they were quite supportive. That was amazing, and the exercise was amazing, and it was even though it was 12 days without washing and lot of heavy, carrying heavy stuff and walking up very, very steep hills. And
What did the exercise comprise?
It was a tactical exercise in several phases, but it was basically a lot of walking uphill with between, at the time, 20 and 40 kilos, because we had a lot of rations in the backpack, and I had my equipment as well. And running, you know, there were attack, retreat. There was an enemy played by friendly forces, and it was just setting up camp in the middle of the night, in the middle of the jungle, and we slept on the ground a couple of times, and because we were tactical, we weren't allowed to wash, which was bad. But it was just overall, the experience was amazing.
Did you get in incredible shape? Were you in great shape beforehand? Did you?
Oh, that's a whole nother story. That. Yeah. But what I also wanted to say was the most beautiful thing about the project really was that the way people opened up to me, and the way people shared their lives with me and shared their stories with me, and soldiers and in particular Gurkhas don't really talk about how they feel and about their experiences. And some of these guys, for some of these guys, I was the first person they'd ever talked to about what they'd experienced in combat. And so I felt very, very privileged. It was a huge honor to experience that kind of trust.
That makes it another aspect that it's hard to come home from that as well.
Yes, that's true. Very much so. But to come back to your fitness question, well, I was when I knew I was going to run with Gurkhas on exercises, I knew I was going to have to get fit. And I did martial arts before, but that really doesn't help you when it comes to endurance. And I remember the U.S. Marines doing something in Afghanistan called CrossFit. Mm-hmm. And it was basically insane amounts of reps of pull-ups, push-ups, flipping tractor tires, skipping rope, rowing, and kettlebell swings, and sit-ups, and it was just, it was...
You didn't do just a little bit of yoga?
No. It was, I remembered seeing them doing that, and I thought, that's what I need to be doing. That's what I need to get in shape to run with Gurkhas. And back home in Austria, I found a gym that actually did it, and they found my project so great that they trained me for free. And
awesome.
So I started doing CrossFit. There was CrossFit also, a big part of CrossFit is Olympic weightlifting, which was hugely important and hugely helpful when you're lugging a lot of stuff around.
Between 12 days worth of food,
yep,
equipment, and photography equipment,
yep,
on top of that.
I was very grateful for the weightlifting training, really, during the exercises. And then down the road, when I was looking for sponsors, because I was running out of money because the whole project was self-financed, CrossFit Inc., the headquarters, which is an American company, became my main sponsor. They just thought, you know, they liked the underdog story, and they just kind of thought, oh, we really like your project. We'll sponsor it. So they gave me quite a bit of money for it, which was great, because I was about, you know, to have to stop the project because I'd run out of money and I'd run out of people to borrow it from, really. So they basically saved it. They saved the project, and they were the best sponsors anybody could really ask for. They were like my cheerleaders during the project as well. But I have such an emotional connection to the sport, not only because of the project, but also because it helped me so much mentally. At the same time as I started the project, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So whenever I got back from a trip, I took care of her, and I didn't deal with it very well initially, emotionally and mentally. And the sport, CrossFit, bizarrely got me through this mentally. So I am hugely grateful to the sport. That was even before there was any sponsorship. So
maybe it gave you sort of emotional discipline.
It makes you really tough mentally, CrossFit, because it just kind of gives you, and I was never somebody who sort of gave up on stuff easily, but that gave me a bit of an edge, because it made me push through phases that I previously hadn't probably been able to push through.
Wow. So,
but so yeah, that got me in shape physically as well, thankfully.
Yeah.
To be able to run with these guys.
Wow.
Because I'm like twice their age pretty much for a lot of these boys.
Yeah.
And it was not easy, but it was a great experience. It just and it ended up taking 3 years from start to finish.
And so at the end of those 3 years, what's next?
I have no idea. The book was on my desk in late September. So, and then I moved to the UK, mm-hmm. and did some press for the book. And I hadn't really sat down until Christmas. So at Christmas, I just sat down. And I've been taking it easy ever since, because after those 3 years, I just wanted a break. I really wanted a break physically and mentally. Mm-hmm. And so I've been going to exhibitions and cooking a lot and meeting friends. And I have a couple of ideas sort of swimming around in my head, but nothing concrete yet. So I'll just, I'm waiting for the right thing to come along now.
Mm. Yeah. And it sounds like the transition, you know, for everyone to civilian life is difficult. How is your mother?
She died in October. So I packed up everything and moved over here.
Right.
And settled here for now. I don't know. I mean, in my life, I've been moving around so much that I'd never know.
Yeah.
Plus, I don't know what, you know, my next project could take me to the other end of the world. I have no idea. But I quite like that as well. I like not knowing what's going to come next.
Mm.
So I'm relaxed about it now, because I think the next project will find me just the way the first one did.
Okay.
I mean, I do occasional jobs for Profil magazine, which is an Austrian foreign affairs weekly. And I take pictures for them occasionally, but they're small jobs. They're sort mm-hmm. of a couple of hours. And I quite like doing that, because I do specialize in portraits. But other than that, nothing.
Okay. We'll see what's next.
Yep.
Alex, thank you so much for coming on Radio Gorgeous.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.